We welcome all of you to a discussion on moral leadership. We had no idea that the vote was going to be taking place today, but the hidden hand still looks down on the Miller Center. We have a special treat by way of prelude to the discussion today. Some 40 plus years ago, my task was to review educational opportunities in Africa, and I visited most of the countries in East and West Africa, and then also interviewed a young man in London. And wherever I went, I heard that one of the great figures in the future of African studies was to be Ali Mazrui. Some of you know him from the television program, The Africans, a triple heritage. Not only was there a BBC public broadcast program on that, but in addition, the book was a bestseller in Britain, the book resulting, and also was the choice of a number of book clubs in the United States, including Book of the Month. Ali Mazrui is indeed the great figure. He went on to become, after having had a fellowship with the Rockefeller Foundation, went on to become lecturer, professor, chairman, dean, the intellectual leader of beautiful little college in Uganda called Makerere College. It suffered in the times of Idi Amin, and has had other challenges, but it continues to function. And Mazrui has been a chaired professor at 8 or 10 universities in this country. He's written numerous books, just to mention a couple, Toward a Pan-African, Africana, The Political Sociology of the English Language, A World Federation of Civilizations, an African Perspective, Political Values and the Educated Class in Africa. More than 20 books, more than 1,000 articles. And he stands today as the great figure in the United States and in African studies. So we thought an introduction to our discussion today, which will follow, would be some brief comments by Professor Mazrui. Those of you who are interested in a fuller presentation may know that he's giving an endowed lecture this afternoon at 3:30 at Minor Hall, and he was kind enough to visit us here. So without further ado, it's a great honor to introduce Ali Mazrui.
Thank you very much indeed. Actually, the honor is mine. I know this is a distinguished place, and Ken Thompson is a distinguished scholar with whom my career has been associated over many years. I regard him as somebody who participated in launching my career, for better or for worse, so he has a lot to answer for. but I also count him as a friend, and I'm very privileged to be able to do that. I must also apologize that I will be here only very briefly because of this other obligation. And my son, Professor Kim Ford Mazrui, who is sitting at the end here, will have to drag me out within 40 minutes or so because there are other engagements I have to attend. So my apologies. I should mention on this issue of leadership and moral considerations, John Dean once came to visit me in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I was a professor at the University of Michigan, and he had an interesting agenda. This was after the Watergate crisis, and he wanted to discuss with me the theme of flawed leaders. Why me? Well, mainly because he knew I had been in some one way or another associated with Idi Amin in Uganda, who had been a dictator in Uganda in the 1970s and was one of the main reasons why I had to leave Africa and move to the United States. Why was John Dean interested in flawed leaders? Well, not just for curiosity, I think he was doing radio programs at that time on flawed leaders in a comparative dimension. Well, I've maintained interest in that as a scholar and also as someone interested in comparative culture, because if moral judgments vary across time from epoch to epoch or even decade to decade, why should they not differ across cultures? So moral variations across time have sometimes been called historical relativism, cross-temporal, and moral variations across societies have often been called cultural relativism, cross-societals. So these variations affect leadership and affect ethics of leadership across both time and cultures. With regard to the present debate within the United States, because I come from three civilizations, I was brought up an African in a Muslim home and was educated in England and the United States. So I'm a product of Africanity, Islam, and Western culture. And in this debate going on in the United States, I have seen those variations of the cultures, even receiving very often faxes. You hear in the United States that it wasn't the adultery that was important, it was the lying under oath which was really bad. Well, this is not a universal position on the ethics of leadership. I have received faxes from Muslims who are shocked by such a scale of values. In many Muslim ethics, it is indeed the adultery which is the most serious offense, a threat to the social order because it is a threat to the family. And under certain interpretation of Islamic jurisdiction, adultery, when one member is actually married, is in fact, or can be, a capital offense. It's regarded as so big a threat to the social order. So I've received faxes which said, what are these Americans talking about? Is the lying that's important? You mean what he did to his family is not important? What the example he sets to the family order is not important? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I was in France last month, understand? Neither the adultery nor the lying about sex, even under oath, is specially a matter of state. So in this case, you have within the same broad civilization of Western, you have a subsection of Western civilization. We said, hey, what's going on in the United States? Neither the adultery nor the lying about adultery, even under oath, is a matter of state. So these are variations across societies and subcultures, cultural relativism in our sense. Now, homosexuality in the first half of the 20th century was a crime almost everywhere in the world. When I was a student in Britain, it was definitely a crime. Certainly male homosexuality was a crime, although lesbianism was not in England at the time. Now, of course, in the second half of the 20th century, it has been legalized in most Western societies with considerable concessions to gay movements. But are we ready yet for a gay president of the United States? And is that part of the converging point between ethics and leadership? Are we ready yet for a gay president of the United States? The death penalty has been abolished in Canada, Western Europe, and at least 30 other countries. It may one day be regarded as a violation of human rights in the United States. But are we ready yet for a US president who is against the death penalty? And that many people regard as an ethical question. That is not just a political, it's an ethical question. And certainly Amnesty International regards it as an ethical question and is using this year to investigate the United States. There used to be a time when some religions regarded the souls of women as less important than the souls of men. Now in the West, are the lives of women regarded as more important than the lives of men when it comes to issue of executions? Now, as you know, last year in February, Carla Faye Tucker was executed in Texas, and she was the first woman to be executed since the U.S. Civil War in Texas. Although 37 men were executed in Texas in 1997, she was also the only woman to be executed in the U.S. since the death penalty was legalized in the 1970s, apart from one dubious case over which there is some debate. Out of every 8 murders in the U.S., you have a woman committing one, but it has been extremely rare for a woman murderer to be executed. How does this affect leadership? It's been relatively easy for a governor to pardon a woman on death row, but much harder to pardon a man on death row. Is the life of a woman valued higher than the life of a man, while the soul of a woman is no longer valued less highly than the soul of a male? Most governors in the United States can risk pardoning a woman on death row much more easily than pardoning a convicted man. Pragmatism clashes with ethics. The definition of corruption in the United States has tightened in the last 40 years. John F. Kennedy, as president, nominated his own brother, Robert Kennedy, to be Attorney General. By the standards of 1961, that was acceptable. By the moral standards of the 1990s, such an appointment was nepotistic and corrupt. Imagine a situation today if Bill Clinton had for his Attorney General his sister. You could imagine the complication this particular situation would have generated. I personally believe that there is a universal moral standard which cuts across cultures and across epochs, but we don't know as yet what that universal standard is. That universal moral standard is being revealed slowly by human history. But human history may still have a long way to go. It's like the old doctrine of predestination in religions like Calvinism and Islam. We may believe everything is preordained, but we have no idea where the destination is. In Calvinism, the answer is to look for signs of the destination. Signals of salvation. They are not conclusive, but they may be road signs. Similarly, with universal moral standards, we just look for signs as to what is universal. But we don't know for certain yet. And as you know, things are changing, and most Americans still believe capital punishment is okay, though most of the rest of the Western world no longer believes capital punishment is okay. And as my son Kim will tell you, this is a hot debate within my own family, with one part of the family arguing that capital punishment is immoral and unethical, and another part saying, no, no, it is required, etc. One final sub-theme for your consideration, that for leadership, we need to distinguish between qualities of leadership and skills of leadership. Qualities of leadership are ones which are more directly affected by ethics. They include vision, George Bush complaining about that vision thing. Secondly, courage, and it may sometimes be tough to do certain things. Thirdly, integrity. And there's been a big debate whether our current president has what it takes. Honesty, number 4, rules of conduct. 5th, sensitivity and feeling for others and empathy. And skills, they include skills of communication, from eloquence to gestures, calculation and anticipation, the art of planning and preempting, that is. Thirdly, persuasion, the art of co-optation. 4th, persistence, to persist and endure. Our president certainly has that. The comeback kid, personal presence, personality, quality of skill. Great threats to leadership include vanity, too much pride and vainglory, greed, often leading to corruption, excessive love of pleasure, Epicureanism. The pleasure can be sexual, alcoholic, drug abuse, or other forms of pleasure, and cruelty, causing unnecessary pain to others, often rivals or political opponents. Mandela, Nelson Mandela, whom I've had great pleasure in meeting and in admiring, closest approximation to the qualities I have mentioned. He has vision, he has courage, he has integrity, honesty, and sensitivity. But Nelson Mandela does not necessarily have all the skills. Communication, calculation, persuasion, persistence, although he does have personal presence. Not skilled enough in calculation, not skilled enough in eloquence. Bill Clinton is the reverse. Closest approximation in all the skills, communication, calculation, persuasion, persistence, and personal presence. He has them all, but not all the qualities. Vision, courage, integrity, honesty, and sensitivity. So they almost are in reverse order of endowment as leaders. One exceptionally skilled, but lacking in ultimate ethical qualities, and the other exceptionally endowed in ethical qualities, but not adequately skilled. Hanging over them, the persistent shadow of cultural relativism, and hanging over their time, the persistent lessons of historical relativism. Thank you very much.
Lauren Henry has held major positions at least four large institutions, University of Virginia, where he was professor of government, Virginia Commonwealth University, where he was dean of the School of Community and Public Affairs, Brookings, where he is the author of the 1960 book on presidential transitions, which laid the basis for the commission that the Miller Center had on presidential transitions. And finally, at a rather unique institution, Public Administration Clearinghouse in Chicago, which brought together different levels of government and practitioners of government, as well as scholars, and remained for many years a kind of home of all kinds of studies of government and leadership. Lauren has kindly agreed to give us some introductory comments, and then you and two of us on the platform, Innes Claude and myself, will also ask questions.
Thank you, Ken, Professor. We meet on a day of some historical interest in which one certainly ought to be able to say something profound and conclusive about moral leadership. I have a fear of rather disappointing. I should confess in advance what will become evident very shortly in any case, that I am not learned or tutored in ethical theory or moral philosophy. I'm a barefoot pilgrim in those realms, so to speak. When Ken asked me to suggest a few lines to put under the picture in the announcements, I suggested that he identify me as a longtime observer of the presidency who knows nothing at all about morals or ethics. I guess that was not dignified enough for the Miller Center, so he closed that over. But we did agree on a title which we thought, or I thought at least, was appropriately modest, calling this Ruminations rather than a lecture or a sermon. We also agreed that it would be good to have me backed up by himself and Innes so that my learned colleagues could bail me out if I got in over my head or save the day. How do I get then to this point? Maybe I should give you just a little bit of background. Like all of us, I suppose, I've been intrigued for a long time with the whole issue or question of ethics and moral leadership in politics, concerned, baffled by its ephemeral nature, frustrated by frequent disappointment of people who we expect to have it or profess to have it. But like a lot of other people, I had not really pushed myself to any statements about this, but I was pushed about a year ago when a former student of mine invited me to come over to Richmond and deliver a paper to some Unitarians on the presidency. And it seemed appropriate at that time, since this was going to be last August, to say something about moral leadership. And I did that, and the Unitarians thought rather better of the paper than I did, I think, but it got some local publicity, which led to my being invited to submit a background paper for a very largely and widely attended public forum in Richmond on values in America, featuring the Bennett brothers, William, the national moralist, and his brother Bob, the sometime attorney for the president. Well, the Bennetts staged what I think turned out, at least from my viewpoint, to be a rather superficial and phony debate, and never got around to talking about my paper, which may have been because it was over their head, but more likely because it was beneath their contempt. At any rate, I, when Ken was asking about who around here has got material which might do for a forum, I showed him these papers, and he thought we might make a forum out of it. I wanted, if I have time, to touch on sort of three areas. One is to do a little groping in the conceptual and terminological fog which seems to me to afflict this business. It seemed to me that people mean several different things when they say moral leadership. They have different kinds of phenomena in mind, and that perhaps a little sorting out of the different ways in which we think about moral leadership may help us to understand a little more what's going on, and perhaps even derive a little comfort from the contradictions which we often see out there in the world. Secondly, I want to touch a little bit on historical experience with presidents and the presidency, looking at the cases of some of our recent presidents and the questions of moral leadership which their careers and their works and the historical judgments about them leave us. This is, to my mind, is an area fraught with contradictions, anomalies, ironies, and paradoxes, and I think we could indulge ourselves in those things for quite a while, but I'll try to keep it short. And thirdly, I want to venture at least tentatively on the very dangerous ground of raising questions about the relationship of moral leadership to politics, and to suggest that at least in some forms and under some circumstances, moral leadership is a very powerful force indeed, which needs to be exercised carefully and indeed can create problems and dangers for a democratic society. So what do we mean by moral leadership, or what do people mean by moral leadership? A lot of the ideas about moral leadership revolve around the person of the leader. the idea of the virtuous man or virtuous woman, with a couple of variations on that. Some are content to hope for the virtuous leader who will just kind of be there, stand there as an object of admiration and emulation and provider of comfort. More generally, though, we think of the leader who draws people to him and draws support for what he or she wants to do, because of the wise, because of the perception that this is a wise and virtuous person, and that therefore what he or she suggests is the good and right thing to do ought to be attended to. There was a back in our founders' times, there was a kind of a view that if George Washington says so, it must be right. Unfortunately, there's not much of that sense. There's another sense about moral leadership in which attention shifts not so much shifts from the person of the leader to the context and the policies or things which the leader proposes. That is, leadership in policies which are justified or explained by reference to moral values in the society or in the polity. And that happens sometimes, it appears, almost without regard to our view of the personal morality of the individual. Then there's another sense, I think a little hard to separate from the previous one, but which I refer to as leadership in the politics of morality. That is, when leaders concentrate on policies more or less specifically and explicitly aimed at particular moral values in society, prohibition of alcohol, restraint or abolition of abortions, and so on. And sometimes this leadership in morals extends far enough so that it succeeds in redefining the moral consensus that holds our society together. It seems to me that if we keep those different ideas of leadership in mind and look at what is going on in relationship to those various approaches to leadership, it may help us understand a little bit of what's going on. Now let's look at experience. Most of us, I guess, like to think that there is some kind of a linkage among these different varieties and levels of leadership. That is, you know, good man, good policy, good results, feeding back to strengthen the moral consensus of the polity, and so forth. Well, if you have that kind of expectation, I think we are in the life we all of us know, most likely to be disappointed most of the time. The linkage just seems to break down in practice. In the first place, speaking now of presidents, perhaps also inferentially of other kinds of politicians, as the old song put it, a good man nowadays is hard to find, and also, for that matter, to elect. I had a pretty good paragraph on that in this one of these papers. Let me venture to read it. There may not be enough of those good people out there visibly available for high public offices, such as the presidency. What kind of a person wants to be president? Candidates profess high ideals and may indeed believe their own rhetoric. But scholars suggest that many of the people who persist in the demanding struggle for a high office are driven by abnormal needs for ego satisfaction that have little to do with policy and can produce dangerous behavior in crisis. Political careers demand alliances, choices, compromise, and deceptions, some of which are almost certain, at least in hindsight, to be morally questionable. Political life at high levels has character eroding aspects. The constant excitement, travel, free spending, mixing with celebrities, applause and sycophancy. All these tend to induce illusions of entitlement and omnipotence. Power as an aphrodisiac is not a new discovery. Modern campaigning, with its apparatus of staged events, skeptical journalism, attack ads, spin and counterspin, all this fogs the political atmosphere and makes discriminating choice by voters difficult. If you grant me that argument, it's very difficult to have much confidence that the people we project into the presidency by our political process are persons of stainless character. Then let's move to the next point, which is that personal virtue does not seem to guarantee political success. I won't dwell on it at great length, but here I suppose the great recent example is President Jimmy Carter, a good man by almost all conventional moral standards, who found the exercise of moral authority effective in a few instances, perhaps most notably in banging heads with Begin and Sadat to produce the Camp David Accords, but not very effective when he suggested that energy conservation was the moral equivalent of war, which didn't go far to encouraging people to leave the cars at home or change the economic structural aspects of the oil and gas industry and a lot of other things. Mr. Carter's lacked some of those skills. Indeed, there were moments when his moral standing, both externally acknowledged and it seemed at times self-perceived, was dysfunctional for his purposes, because he found it difficult to take counsel. He found it difficult to compromise, because almost by definition, moral judgments and moral issues sometimes are difficult or impossible conceptually to compromise. Against the difficulty of finding morally impeccable leaders and the uncertainties about what they can accomplish, we have the more common situation of morally flawed leaders who produce morally significant results. For example, let's say John F. Kennedy, whose personal life has been much written and discussed, and who would himself have been almost embarrassed to present himself as a moral exemplar, but who was capable, I think, of rising on occasions. It seems to me that if you look at his achievement in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he almost alone among his colleagues faced up squarely to the possible consequences of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union and backed down some of his more bellicose advisors and insisted on giving Khrushchev a way out, that seems to me was moral leadership of a high order. We can say the same thing for his successor, President Johnson, a thorough rascal in many respects. And yet left behind achievements in the realm of civil rights and so on, for which he's now widely expected. And there are paradoxes. Harry S. Truman, who's presently, at least, considered one of our near great presidents, admired for his sturdy honesty and so forth. Well, golly, in his own time, Mr. Truman was widely criticized as having emerged from the political machine, which he never disavowed, for engaging in nepotism. He put his wife on the Senate payroll, which would be a no-no now. He consorted with low characters in the White House. soiled those precincts by engaging in games of chance in which money was exchanged. Much to be criticized for in his own times and moral standing, and yet he's widely considered a man who achieved moral things in his lifetime, but has also hanging over him the great moral question, of course, of whether it was appropriate to use the nuclear bomb. Richard Nixon, whose moral standing is not very widely applauded presently, I would venture to suggest, at least, that Nixon's movement to reestablish relationships with China and to reverse years of agitation among Republicans and others about who so-called lost China, indeed agitation to which he had contributed, this was a risky political thing to do, but it achieved significant results in terms of establishing American relations on the Far East, which greatly diminished the possibility of war. Another more recent example, take Mr. Reagan, who I consider a well-meaning fellow, but hardly greatly sophisticated in moral philosophy. He detested nuclear weapons, and he detested communism, both certainly moral stands, but he set about defeating those things by what I consider the morally inelegant means of an indiscriminate arms race, which spent the Soviet Union into exhaustion. So moral leadership, it seems to me, it's discontinuous, both in the lives of individuals and in the experience of nations. It emerges sometimes from unlikely people, flawed individuals. It's usually controversial in its own time, and sometimes it's recognizable only in hindsight. Well, how do flawed people achieve these things? Well, they do it by relating their policies to the great underlying moral consensus of the United States. What Gunnar Myrdal referred to as the American Creed, with fundamental notions of freedom, equality, justice, and so on, and many of these sanctified in our great historic texts, like the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address and so forth. Now let me go to the really out on the limb and raise questions about whether our politics should be more explicitly in moral terms. If politics has any significant or meaning, I suppose it must ultimately be about things like freedom and justice and equality and so forth. And yet, how can we relate ordinary politics, how can politicians relate their careers to these values? I have a kind of a picture in my head of the spheres of politics and the spheres of morality rubbing around and rubbing against each other, constantly wanting to fuse, but never quite becoming the same thing, and probably a good thing. Issues defined in moral terms become of a different order, sometimes almost sacred, and difficult to handle within the framework of a political system. In a democratic, diverse, open society, there are bound to be differences of opinion, differences of moral priority, and particularly differences of opinion about which of these needs to be brought into and settled or advanced through the political process. there's a constant temptation and danger to overload the moral agenda. And to do so invites stalemate conflict. The moral consensus becomes brittle. This becomes particularly dangerous because under some circumstances, if the issue is defined as moral, then it becomes immoral to compromise. And indeed, in extreme cases, all sorts of vengeance against the immoral opponents becomes justified. So it seems to me that great political leadership is kind of an exercise in moral perception, selective moral perception, juggling, and sometimes even deferral. Here again, let me come back to some of the ironies, particularly LBJ. Reprehensible behavior in almost, in a great many respects, and you know the whole litany of relations with others, financial greed, womanizing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He does appear, according to his biographies, to have been genuinely committed to doing things in his political career which would advance the fortunes of the less fortunate people in society. Although he found it difficult to separate that general goal from the vision of LBJ himself accomplishing this. He committed himself to this Great Society program, which he thought, at least, was appropriate to his moral objectives, in order to protect, he thought, the Great Society. He first of all engaged in deceptions about the significance and the cost and the depth of commitment on the Vietnam War. Interestingly, Martin Luther King and others began to heat up the civil rights question, Johnson was outraged, considering this a spoiling movement, which would interfere with his goal of doing things for the people generally. So, of course, the outcome of the Vietnam War was a disaster, and most people think that the Great Society itself was a disaster. And the civil rights accomplishment, which he rather backed into reluctantly, stands as perhaps his greatest moral achievement. Go back further into history, you might look at the case of Lincoln and the slavery issue in the Civil War. As the war came on, Lincoln has, I read the history, had made clear his personal opposition to slavery. But he was also very reluctant to make slavery the issue of the war. Did his best as the war was coming on and in its early stages to settle the secession business on a legal constitutional basis and to keep the issue of slavery off to one side, for which he was berated as morally obtuse by the abolitionists who had the moral high ground. And Lincoln embraced slavery as a war aim only later on when it became clear that there would be some military means of making it effective and that the South was dug in. He also, I think, sensing the capacity of a moral issue to turn into a search for revenge, began laying the basis in his later pronouncements, such as the second inaugural address, for reconciliation. going back to where we are at this moment today, I suspect that almost all of us, from whatever our personal political persuasions and whatever our views about what ought to have happened, as a result of the impeachment process, feels some sense of frustration. Well, if it's any encouragement, let me suggest that within the lifetimes of most of us here, We had a president who was recognized to have great political charm, skill, and empathy, who was very popular. He encouraged a great many people to believe that the policies he was advancing advanced their personal well-being. He was triumphant electorally. He was despised by a great many people on the ground that he was, as many of his colleagues thought, a deceptive and devious fellow who would tell you what what you wanted to hear, and who was capable of very large whoppers on the campaign platform and elsewhere. We know now, we didn't know then, that he carried on a long-term extramarital affair. Throughout a long political career, he, on the whole, treated the question of civil rights in America and the state of black minorities with benign neglect. Although he must have known a great deal about what was happening to the Jews in Europe, he avoided making that a major issue of the war because presumably he felt that that would overload the moral agenda, unleash passions, create demands that he couldn't satisfy. Well, you know, of course, who I'm talking about, Franklin Roosevelt, who historians at least consider one of our presidents. Whether Mr. Clinton will have a war or other opportunities to rise to the level of Mr. Roosevelt seems doubtful, but at least we can always hope.
Kim Mazrui has given me permission to ask this question before Professor Mazrui leaves. Are there parallels to the kind of thing that Justice Holmes talked about when he said, some people admire the man of principle. I admire the man who can find his way through a maze of conflicting moral principles. Are there examples in other civilizations and cultures of that kind of a problem come to mind for Mazrui?
This is my son putting me on the spot. it's true that principles are always more than one in any given situation that is of great political significance. If it's an issue of great political significance, there's always more than one principle at stake. And the exercise of morality is a kind of ethical calculus in determining which particular principle should have priority in a given situation. So the example of whether Truman was morally justified to use the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, definitely the debate has included a variety of principles on that issue, ranging from whether it saved lives to whether the Japanese were chosen because they were not Germans, and that the Germans would not have been subjected to similar punishment. So in general, I think my position would be that horrendous issues involving decision-making necessitate an ethical calculus because there are always more than one principle.
We thank you very much. I know you have to go, but we appreciate your spending this time with us.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all for your courtesy. Thank you.
Professor Claude has some questions.
Yeah, I do have some questions for Lauren.
Not for me. I thought you were going to banquet.
But I'm going to do a little meandering first, if I may.
Get launched out there before we get to
the... I think Lauren has contributed to a great deal to our thinking in many ways, including the distinctions he's helped us to be conscious of among, I think, at least three aspects of the morality of leadership. The moral quality of the personal behavior of the leader, on the one hand. Secondly, the moral quality of his teaching, the rhetoric, the use of the bully pulpit. It's quite possible that a leader whose personal moral behavior is not a first rate may be an excellent preacher of morality to his society. And thirdly, the moral quality of the actual policy objectives and or attainments of the leader. And the focus has been on this third, the morality, not so much pertaining to the question how good a man or woman is this leader, but how much good does he or she do for society? What does he contribute to the moral quality of the society? I want to suggest a couple of other distinctions, also relevant, I think, to this general topic. Distinctions relating to the functional definition of morality or moral principle. First of all, I think morality is sometimes a positive guide to action. It inspires us to work for worthy goals. It defines appropriate ends and inspires us, urges us on in pursuit of those ends. In short, morality may be a definer of our duties, of the proper aims of our activity. That I like to call hard morality. It inspires and guides our activity. Secondly, morality is sometimes a check, a negative force. It defines limits. It restricts the means that we choose. It inhibits improper actions. In the paper, although not in this public performance today, Lauren went so far as to invoke the Ten Commandments. In this respect, or at least one of them. And he inspired me to look back at Exodus 20 and review those commandments. And I found that at least 8 and possibly 9 of them have to be described as negative versions of the function of morality. Thou shalt not do bad things, defining those bad things that are not to be done. The one about honoring the Sabbath could go either way. That's a positive thing, to honor the Sabbath, but it's defined in terms of not working on the Sabbath day. So there's a negative quality even to that one. Well, I call this soft morality. Morality sometimes inspires us to vigorous action. At other times, it inhibits our action. It lays a check on the means that we adopt and on the methods that we pursue. And we need to constantly ask the question, I think, which type, the hard or the soft, the positive or the negative version of morality, is more relevant to moral leadership in political life? Well, I think it's clear that Lauren has tended to emphasize not the personal morality of the leader, but the public morality in the sense of the public teaching and the public leadership in public policy toward the achievement of valuable objectives. In that sense, the focus is on hard morality, letting moral principles serve to be criteria for the adoption of policy. Not the question, is the president, for instance, a good man, but does he use his office to do good things? To help the society, to inspire and cause the society to do good things and achieve good ends. I think there's a large question as to whether we can, in fact, really separate these aspects of morality. There is bound to be some linkage, whether we like it or not, I think, between the personal behavior of a president and his capabilities as a moral leader in the policy realm. Clearly, we have many examples of bad men who do good things in public office. Or I suppose, to put it more accurately, one would say seriously flawed men who do some good things along with some bad things as public servants. Indeed, there is the phenomenon in political life of bad leaders doing good things for the wrong reasons. and we have to be grateful for the achievement of good things, even with the wrong kind of motivation. However, I think there is, and this leads directly to one of my questions, I think there is the fact, and a very significant fact, that our past leaders, including those as recent as LBJ and John F. Kennedy, had personal flaws, flaws in their personal behavior, that were largely concealed from the public, never came to public attention in a major way. And we now have a very different situation in which personal immorality of our leaders is bound to be spread on the front page and to recur constantly on the television screen. Everybody knows about the misbehavior of Bill Clinton. Very few people had it called to actively to their attention that John F. Kennedy was a womanizer and did reckless things of that sort, or that Franklin Roosevelt had the personal flaws that have been described. This makes a difference, I think. I raise the question, is it likely to be for the personal immorality of a president to be more damaging to the possibility of moral leadership in public policy than it previously was? Hypocrisy may be the good thing here. If you can hide your flaws, then you can be an effective moral leader in public policy. If your flaws are spread out for everybody to see, you may be thereby inhibited and handicapped in promoting good public policy. So I think we need to raise the question whether a conspicuously immoral president can be an effective preacher, persuading the public to elevate its standards of public values, and can he be an effective political leader in the sense of pushing and pulling so that good public policy is achieved? We may have a couple of years ahead of us to find out how seriously, if at all, President Clinton is handicapped and being a moral leader by the fact that everybody knows that personally his moral standards leave something to be desired. Second question before I stop this, how does and can a moral leader in public office meet the problem of disagreement about what is good public policy? If moral leadership consists in doing good things, then we have to define which things are good and which things are not so good. I happen to think that Franklin Roosevelt was a moral leader in winning World War II against the Axis powers. But I suggest that there are some absolute pacifists in our society who don't believe that at all. They would not talk that up as a piece of moral leadership on the part of FDR. Clearly today, there are many in our society who believe that public morality entails defending the right of women to choose abortion at will. But we have to face the fact that there is another segment of our society which thinks that public morality consists in limiting or even prohibiting abortion. There's the conflict of values. Which is good public policy, doing this or doing the opposite? We are tempted, I think, always to convict those, our political opponents, of moralizing politics. I'm on this side, the people on the other side are trying to inject morality into politics when they oppose my position. But the truth is that you get it on both sides. When we identify moral leadership as the pursuit of policy objectives that we find, that we approve, we're inclined to regard that as moral leadership. And the same is true of those who differ from us. So I think we do have to face two questions here. The first, is it true that publicized personal immorality on the part of a leader is a handicap to good public policy leadership? And the question of dealing with the lack of consensus on the values that do constitute the basis for doing good, for voting morality in a public sense.
We've really come to the end of our hour. If you wanted to make a few brief comments.
I think Ennis is sufficiently close to my position on these issues that I won't take time to comment further.
Well, this may leave all of this in suspense. If somebody has a question which simply can't be held or discussed in private with the members who sat at this end of the room, raise your hand. If not, why, thank you very much for coming out.